I've got lots of clergy friends that I've been in touch with over the last couple of weeks as we saw these lessons coming. Most of us try to read ahead. I'll admit, there was a Sunday when I didn't know what the gospel lesson was going to be until the deacon read it. Okay? I wasn't here, by the way. It was at another location. So you don't have to worry about it if you heard that sermon. But very often, the gospel lessons have more import than they would on other occasions. And I love that question when Jesus says, "So what do you read in the law?" And one of my buddies said, Jesus just as easily could have said, "And what do you read in the news?" And so there's a lot going on. And I want to acknowledge that there is a tension in the air. And it has to do with a concept, or at least in some ways, an area where the ideas and definition of neighborliness come into application. It just does. And is it okay for me to admit that? Are you all okay with me saying neighborliness is on the agenda in our lives, in our societal lives, in our cultural lives? It's on the agenda. But I want to get at it this way. I grew up Southern Baptist. Y'all know that. Don't hold that against me. I don't. But I do this, though. I try to acknowledge the ways in which that upbringing, deeply biblically based, with a high moralism, or at least let's just say a strict moralism, some of it not real high, but still very strict, okay? Like, we couldn't play cards on Sunday afternoon kind of thing, okay? That's not real high, but that sure is strict. But I grew up in that world. One of the pieces of Southern Baptist ethos is, and I think it is one of the things that led to the split of the church when the conservative takeover occurred in the late 80s, early 90s. The fundamentalists started stacking the elections at their conventions, and the next thing you know, they're split. Baptists split, and the moderate ones, the old school Baptists really, went to groups called the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship and the Alliance of Baptists. Jimmy Carter's church in Plains is a member of the Alliance of Baptists. And then the Southern Baptists became more conservative. They kicked all the women who were on faculties at all the seminaries out. That happened. They got really, really strict. But another piece of that division was that, and this is my own opinion, it's hard to use underdogism when you're the second largest denomination in the country. The only Christian group larger than Southern Baptists was Roman Catholics. And they are still, after their split, the second largest Christian denomination in the United States. Even this downsized Southern Baptist denomination is still the second largest. But back then, they were huge. And it's hard to use underdog ideas when you are that big. You have that much sway, that much say. The biggest church in most southern towns is the Baptist Church. Now, that things have changed since then. But part of that ideology was an underdog ideology. Part of it was us against the world. Part of it was the devil is out there to get us all, and he's a big enemy, and it's just us. And we got to hunker down, and we got to really fight for the right. And there was this tone that imbued its way all the way across. And we were told that we were underdogs by way of it. That's what I grew up in. That was the world I grew up in. I think that's where some of that harshness comes from, some of that brittleness comes from, too. And y'all have seen it. And so when I became an Episcopalian, which when people ask me how in the world did that happen, and my answer is by the grace of God. When I became an Episcopalian, I moved into another world. Because our world is not a world of underdogs, is it? It just isn't. The first church I served was Good Shepherd in Augusta, the wealthiest church in the Diocese of Georgia. Gorgeous piece of property. If you haven't seen it, go see it. It's worth a day's drive. It really is. Just go to Augusta, walk the grounds, come back home, and you'll go, wow. It's incredible. It's an incredible place. And the congregation is a long-standing congregation, post-Civil War, but still using buildings that are nearly that old. The worship space they occupy now is 1880s. It was rebuilt in the 1880s after a fire. And so it has lots of that Victorian stuff that used to be like on the front of the parish house that's gone now. That look. Lots of gingerbread and stuff like that. Just gorgeous. Just gorgeous. And it's in Augusta's poshest neighborhood, the Hill, Somerville is the way you say it. Somewhere. And you have to kind of go, cool. Somewhere. All right, right there on Walton Way, right across from Reed Memorial Church, which is where Eisenhower would worship when he was in town. Lots of customs, lots of stuff going on. The property that Good Shepherd sits on is now the result of 22 separate land acquisitions or swaps, trading backyards with their neighbors and buying out certain sections so that they could also expand the school that's on the property. Good Shepherd is the home of the Episcopal Day School, which was Augusta's first school to integrate. Alan Clarkson, who was the rector there for 37 years, starting in the 50s and all the way through, led that movement. Alan was responsible for starting churches in Beach Island, South Carolina. Five other churches in the Augusta Convocation, Alan helped get going. He was an incredible person, lots of energy. Good Shepherd was the church on the hill. And then there was St. Paul's downtown. St. Paul's is the second oldest Episcopal church in Georgia after Christ Church Savannah. So history out the wazoo, okay? But there was always that other church. If you want to see sheep stealing, who's the record at St. Paul's? We'll go there now. And then Good Shepherd gets somebody, we'll go there now. Okay. There was the back and forth between St. Paul's and Good Shepherd was silly. But those two churches, and so there was a little bit of competition. St. Paul's downtown was always the mother church of the Augusta area, and they sat on that throne well. And so when Good Shepherd started to rise to prominence, there was a chest puffing part to it. You know what the school that Good Shepherd started, Episcopal Day School, K-8, pretty much so takes over Walton Way when school starts in the morning, and then pick up at 3 o'clock. Walton Way belongs to Good Shepherd. Okay? And the carpool line encircles the church and goes around. We get our own cop every day to direct traffic. And you know what EDS really stands for? Everybody drives suburban. So this little Baptist boy moved there, and I was drowning in a world of privilege that I had never seen before, in a church. And I don't want to put this down. That church, like us, led the community in outreach. The things that Good Shepherd did were enormous, a Habitat House every year kind of thing. They were busy. They were good. When the United Way held their annual meeting, it was an array of the black ministers in town, and myself or the rector of Good Shepherd, and then the rabbi from the synagogue, and that was it. We were the board for the United Way. So nothing wrong with how good they were to the community. As a matter of fact, on the wall, over the door, above the narthex, the stained glass window there, which was not a Tiffany, but the next best thing downhill, okay, was the Good Samaritan window. And so every Sunday, if you were sitting in the chancel, if you were preaching, that was what you saw. Those were the people you saw. That was the mentality. They were good at that. Their privilege hadn't gotten in the way. They really gave of themselves to their community for the good of their community. And that privilege didn't poison them quite like I've seen it poison other communities. And so it was really a lesson for me. I learned how to live differently with the things that were my privileges too. And I got to shed that underdog mentality a little bit. And so I thank God for Good Shepherd and their witness to me and what I learned about that. But I saw privilege like I'd never seen it before. I see it here too. Y'all aren't puffy with it, but you've got it. It's okay. It is how our lives are in this world. There's a handful of us that are members of this church that make that our annual income in our households is less than $30,000 a year. There's a handful of people that's your circumstances. For the most part, we're on the other side of that number. And some of us way on the other side of that number. If you make $30,000 a year in your household, you're in the top 5% on the planet. So we complain about the 1%. We're in the 5. Most people on the planet live on less than $2 a day. So let's be honest about our privilege. We've got it. It's not a bad thing. I mean, that's what Good Shepherd taught me. But it can create its own slippery slopes, its own delusions. We can learn to live our lives in that privilege, and we can still make mistakes. We can still be wrong, even with those privileges. Another piece to this, too, as a preliminary. In the last couple of weeks, again, maybe coincidental, maybe these folks were looking ahead, maybe they saw the Good Samaritan lesson coming. But two of your fellow parishioners in the last couple of weeks have communicated with me by email, sharing a story about their encounter with a homeless person and about how they reached out a little extra, gave them more money than they were asking for, or engaged them in conversation, did more than just a simple drop a dollar in a hat kind of thing. And then how in that interaction with the person, got some eye to eye with them and came away enriched by the encounter. And so there's something about that that I want to say too. I want to say yes to that. But I also want to say that what it does is it exposes something about what we need to learn about ourselves too. Because in both instances, and I'm not faulting these people, but in both instances, they were able to get in their cars and drive off and go to an air-conditioned home where there's plumbing and there's food in the pantry. Okay? So as beautiful as it was and as enriched by the encounter that they gave some of themselves to, there was still, privilege was the last address they used. See what I mean? And again, I'm not picking on folks. It was beautiful, the stories they told. Every single one of you has a story like that you reached out a little farther and it made a difference to you. So all of that goes into where I am as I read the gospel today and want to look at it in a way that really says a truth to us from our truth, from the facts on the ground. The question that most of us respond to when we read this gospel is, who is my neighbor? And most of us try to answer it in the most benevolent way we can, in the most generous way we can. Heck, some of us even quote the prayer book that we're supposed to respect the dignity of every human being. And we start to do our own little puppet up. But the more important question in this pericope is the one that Jesus asks at the end. And he asks the lawyer, the person of privilege, who's the better neighbor? Who's the neighbor to this man who was destitute on the roadside? Who's the neighbor? That's a different question. Because it's not a question that can be answered from privilege. It's not a question like we would want to hear and we would want to answer, because one of the things that goes with privilege is getting to be the decider in the room. Do you know what I mean? When you go to meetings, when you participate in community events, if you're the donor, you have a say that's different than the one that the people who are the beneficiaries of your program get to make. I'm not mad at you. That's not wrong. You got to make good decisions. We want to help. We're supposed to do all those things. There are people beaten up and bloodied on the side of the road. We've got to do something about it. Let's not be priests for sure. Or Levites. Yes to that. But let's not think that we're the ones who get to decide who our neighbors are. That's an act of privilege. What we need to do is to read this story so that we see ourselves on the roadside, beaten up and bloodied, lost, robbed, hijacked. And it's from that perspective that we start to see who our neighbors are, who God has put in the world around us and said, there's your neighbor. That's why Jesus asks the question that he asks at the end. It's because it's not a point of privilege. It's an act of mercy that makes neighbors. And every single one of us needs God's mercy. No matter what side of the road we're on. Don't you feel sorry for that priest? A little bit? Don't you think, man, what was he thinking? Oh my goodness, a priest. But you know what? He's got a congregation to take care of, and he can't get himself all dirty. He can't play in those games. He's just supposed to walk on the other side of the road so that he can be in church on Sunday and be all nice and bright and shiny and green. Or that Levite. Levites, I think, are the closest thing to a Levite in the Episcopal Church is a member of the vestry. Sorry to all the members of the vestry. Something's got to get us across to the other side of the road, but one of the reasons we need to go is because we need to acknowledge that part of our lives have been hijacked already. Privilege is the hijacker, by the way. What? Father David? What would you do without your privilege? Who would you be without your privilege? Would I recognize you without your privilege? Doesn't your privilege protect you a little bit from the world? Doesn't it occupy you at times when you wish you didn't have to mess with mortgages and bills and taxes? Isn't there something about privilege which is a great place to hide from those decisions you don't get to make? Oh, Father Dan, there you go meddling. There you go. But look what side of the road I'm on. Take this stuff off. I think there's something about our lives, like I was saying last week, about addiction, remember? When we live our lives on second best,
It's never enough. And the response to living your life on second best is always addiction. You always need more of it. You always have to go back because it's never enough. And so there is something about our privilege, I think, that consumes us and is a substitute for another life on the other side of the road, and for recognition and identification with it, for solidarity with the homeless person. If we don't see ourselves as broken and bloodied and hijacked, where do we put God's mercy when it comes? What wounds does God nurse with wine and oil? If we're on the wrong side of the road. Y'all, I think there's more to this Samaritan story than the one we learned as children, which you can summarize in two words. Be nice. That's what most of us have done. I mean, if you whittle it down, that's where that goes. Or maybe this. Be nicest. I think there's something more going on. Jesus is talking to a privileged person. And he has to ask him the question, so who's the neighbor out of all of these? And it's a Samaritan, a half-breed. They're not even from Georgia. Thank you all for putting up with me learning how to live under the privileges that God has bestowed my life. I'm still learning. We probably all should still be learning because our lives of privilege will take us down the wrong side of the road if we let them. And we will miss not just the man who needs us, but we will miss the truth that helps us to see the need we have for God's mercy. Here's the good news. There are Samaritans out there. There are people in the world right now through whom God's mercy flows. And they do it with no strings attached. Here's two denarii. I'll be back. The good news is God's mercy doesn't wait on our privilege. The good news is God is merciful and we need it, and there it is. Even when we're on the wrong side of the road. Thank God. Thank God for God's mercy. We need to understand this dynamic about our lives and the ways in which we thwart God's mercy. We need to understand these things. This is going to go into our toolkit, our owner's manual. We're going to have to use this again and again. Otherwise, we won't be as good at proclaiming the resurrection as we would like to be. All of that. I thank you for letting me say all of that. Because I know how much more appealing the simpler take on the story is, be nicest. I know how much more we would rather it be that way and never have our privileges questioned.
good news again, and closing, and finally, and the most important thing, best for last. It doesn't matter what side of the road you're on. God is merciful. Amen.